It is definitely wildfire season, and we got a bunch of them burning around the state. And one of the things that happens when the governor calls for a state of emergency is firefighters tend to go from different areas around the state to the fires. And joining me now is Matt House and Blair Campbell. They are with me this morning. And Blair, I understand you just came back from a conflagration.
Yes, that's correct. I was over on the Boneyard Fire, the Lone Rock Fire, Monkey Creek when they merged, and it became the Battle Mountain Complex.
When the call first comes out, is it a volunteer basis who goes?
So we built out a schedule all year long because an emergency can come out any time of the year. But we have certified employees and personnel that go out on them to the fires or the emergencies that the governor calls us on.
So let me add to that, okay, if I can. So when a conflagration is enacted, we have what we call Western Lane, Western Douglas County Fire Defense Support in this area. And then all the other counties have a fire defense board. So we cannot send a task force out individually, so we attach to a task force upon request. So this particular one, they were attached to Marion County as a task force. So they had, the state was so low on resources, they had to draw from everybody in order to send a task force. A task force is like a strike team. It's five different units, or it could be five similar units that go out. So they have multiple resources going to help it take care of this incident.
Is it like 22 individuals per task force? Is that about
depends on the apparatus you send out. So there's different typings of engines, tenders, and all that, and it requires anywhere from 2 to 4 people on each apparatus.
Okay. When you said we can't go out on an individual basis, is that because of the size of our area and the amount of resources that we have?
And we're not available to send a strike team or a task force yet by ourselves in the Western Lane and Western Douglas County task force.
But that's mainly because of size, right?
Yeah, and we're developing it. In fact, we just reenacted it and reestablished the Western Lane, Western Douglas County. Man, that's a mouthful. We just reestablished that fire defense board two years ago. Right. It had been kind of falling on the wayside. But the need of it is when people call for help, we on the Western Lane, Western Douglas County, which includes Reesport, Gardner, Winchester Bay, we can help send resources out for the need, wherever the need is.
Now, so far, with the exception of our Mapleton fire a couple of years ago, we've been pretty much untouched here in this area by major stuff. Are we a little bit more able to send resources because you're not worried about cutting yourself short here on the coast?
We'll never cut ourselves short.
Okay.
I mean, in fact, I was super proud of our agency, Western Lane Fire and EMS. They were able to send two different units and attach to a task force, one with Lane County, one with Marion County, which Blair was a part of. And then we were able to backfill and not skip a beat within our own community. So number one, our priority is always take care of our community. So if we can't do that first, we won't send out when a call for help happens. If that call for help happens and we can backfill, then yeah, absolutely, we'll send out.
Is a conflagration called basically when structures and individuals are at risk, or is it just the size of a fire itself?
All the above.
Yeah, yes. Where we deal with more like on the fire side, it's more when those wildfires, or it could be a tsunami, it could be a tornado, an earthquake, whatever the case may be. But they can call upon us at any time, you know, for help. They need whatever, and we can go help.
We talk about wildland conflagrations. The number one priority for us is life safety, property conservation. So those are our two tasks that we usually get to when we go on the wildland incidents.
Yep.
So Blair, talk about when the call comes up and you head out there, you get on scene. What are some of the first things that you have to familiarize yourself with when you get there?
So the big thing is our strike team leaders. So you have that one person or two people that will get with the IC teams or the incident management team, go over, you know, that stuff. And then as far as an engine boss, which is my cert, and I take care of the engine, the personnel on my crew, as well as the other resources, I help with that. So our first thing is we have probably never been in this area, so our first task, if possible, is we want to make ourselves familiar with it, know the area, get to know it somewhat, where it's like, okay, these are escape routes, this is where we can go hide if we need to get to a safety zone, to let the fire blow by, to do its thing, but we want to make sure that our safety is number one at all times, no matter what. It's kind of a rough way to look at it, but sometimes you have to lose structures in order to keep the personnel safe, because if we get hurt, there's nobody else there to help.
And I guess there's a difference in how you look at things based on whether it's a valley or a mountainous area.
Absolutely. You know, topography, the elevation, wind changes, the heat, the humidities, you know, the time of day. So it's night or is it, you know, noontime when the sun's at its highest and it's, you know, getting to that hot part of the day.
Now, I know fires can erupt and go anywhere, but is there any kind of science down about okay, we have this mountainous region facing this way, wind's going this way. Is there any way of like kind of predetermining where the fire might go?
Absolutely, absolutely. So, you know, if the, you know, the wind's going right up a valley and, you know, it's a steep grade and you got structures up there, we can pre-plan, get resources up there, and they may have to stay up there for anywhere from 12 to even 24 hours, depending on whether or not the access to it and if they can even save it.
In these incidents, they have incident management teams that are assigned to them for overall, and each incident management team has a meteorologist assigned to them. So they're doing frequent weather checks to see wind direction, humidity. Humidity plays into this huge. The relative humidity, wind direction plays into this huge. Temperature, all big variables into wildland fire.
Yeah. But if an area is extremely dry, like some of the eastern part of the state tends to be, how much does the humidity help? I mean, because you would think if you have a lot of fuel, you know, it's going to burn at some point. How much does it play into it?
The higher the humidity, so when the humidity gets really bad and fire activity or fire behavior increases is when you're in those teens, 20 into the 20s or even lower than that, it's extremely bad. And it can run, the fire will run and just burn everything in its path. The higher the relative humidity, the safer it is, the more moisture you have in the air, things like that. So at nighttime, usually we can gain more ground to corral a fire or contain it so it's not as bad. So we can help keep it all in one area so the less destruction.
A good way of looking at it too, like Blair said, like if the relative humidity is in the teens or 20s, and if we go, it's like in our area, our relative humidity is in the 40s, it's a lot harder for the fire to burn. It's like twice as hard for the fire to catch and to run.
And, you know, someone who grew up in the desert, you know, you know when it's low humidity, but you can't really see it.
No.
You know, you can't really know for sure. So you definitely have to depend on the meteorologist for that.
Yeah, and they have meteorologists. They actually have fire behavior analysts that go through all that to get your fuel moisture content in your hour fuels, your 10-hour fuels, 100-hour fuels, 10,000-hour fuels, and that's anywhere from little grass to big timber.
And when a strike team goes out there, they, like you said, there's different units that go out there. You're in charge of the truck and that, but there's also like ground crew, right?
People
go out and dig ditches and like pave the way and put breaks in between.
Yeah. So for like our responsibilities task is we go out as a structural task force. So we're mainly tied to structures. We also absolutely help out the wildland aspect of it. And those are your hand crews, contract engines, dozers, things like that, other forestry equipment. They'll have feller bunchers and things like that cutting down trees to make a bigger path to create the safe place. And we will go sit with them. We'll help them dig line. We'll clear stuff out of the way just to make sure that we can do everything possible to stop this fire war.
Yeah, the fire breaks are probably one of the most important things that we can establish. And fire break is a line. Like in down in California, you look at the mountains as you're driving past and you see this huge swath of land cut out. That's a fire break because all the fire activity they have down there. So what we're doing,
they pre-plan those sometimes.
Oh, absolutely.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. So what we're doing is taking away in fire, there's three different things that fire has to have in order to go. If you're taking away the combustion part, you know, where it can actually have something to burn by putting in that like half a mile long break, fire break is what it's called in a mountain.
I want to get to the defensible space aspect of this since you deal with structures and that, but I also want to ask about wildlife. Wildlife has the freedom to go and run and that, but is there a significant loss of wildlife in fires like this?
Yeah.
I imagine the small animals that can't really get away. But.
Absolutely, absolutely. And, you know, it's down to the mice, the snakes, the deer, the whatever's out there, the birds, you know, they can get away a little bit easier. But it even goes into livestock, cattle, horses, goats, sheep, all that stuff that when a fire starts, they have teams and volunteers that actually they get on like Facebook pages. Hey, I've got a horse trailer and this many acres 100 miles away. I'll come help and they'll evacuate them. They set up livestock evacuation points far enough away from the fire that they can help evacuate those animals.
Again, I would say it depends on the fire behavior. The faster the fire, the more unfortunate deaths would occur. If it's not as fast-moving fire behavior, the animals generally can get retreat out of the area.
Now, I think it's late April or early May when we start airing PSAs around here about defensible space, about, you know, protecting your house and that, clearing away, stuff like that. What, clearing your roof off, what are some of the other things that people can do to kind of create that, and then you can tell your story, or you, if you want to tell your story first.
No, absolutely. Yeah, we can go into defensible space. I mean, that's where it starts, you know. So here on the Oregon coast, yes, we have lots of humidities and things like that to help us in our fire season. Usually, generally doesn't start until the middle of July or even August, and then it goes from there. But one of the big things is, as you said, you know, getting the pine needles and leaves and stuff off your roof and your gutters, but it goes down to even grass and plants and potted plants and what those are made of. If they're made of wood, getting those away from the house, you know, 50 feet, that it creates a fuel load next to your house. So a lot of the houses around here are stick frame homes, and they have either wood siding or even the composite siding, the concrete siding, which can burn, but it helps reflect that heat and keeps the flames from being able to catch it on fire. So we go through and we'll remove plants and brush, and you know, it's, I know it's decorative, but we'll remove all that stuff away from the house far enough to be able to save your home. It all goes into the plan that, you know, at the end of it, there will be volunteers and fire resources that can come in and help put that stuff back to so you can live your life and create your home.
Yeah. But then again, you know, if the danger is there, who really wants to have that stuff?
Yes, exactly. And we've never been argued with or anything like that had any negative impact on, you know, removing stuff.
Folks, we can save your blue spruce, buddy, or we can save your house. Which one do you want?
Absolutely. Right? You know, the blue spruce, hopefully it'll heal and it'll continue to grow. And sometimes they don't. But it's more cost effective than losing your home, and then you have nothing.
Yeah, another way of looking at it, we talked about the fire breaks, you know, the same thing. We're taking away the fuel so it doesn't get to your house.
So tell me your story about your defensible space story.
So one of the houses that we were in charge of as far as the strike team was a beautiful house. It's up on a ridge top and a valley on both sides. As Matt said, that we had fire breaks that were going around it, nice wide dozer tracks around it, probably 40 feet wide. We get called up early that we need to get out on the hill early the one day, and so we head out there. And as we're making our way up the driveway, coming up to the fire break, we have live fire activity right there. So we get up to the top of the house, get the rig parked, tie in with the day shift team that's there. We were on night shift. Get to kind of scuttlebutt what's going on. They have a lookout watching the fire come up the hill. We get our rig in place, get our equipment in place, and the fire's coming right at us. Comes right next to the home. Starts going over the other side, and not too bad, you know. Wind is cooperating with us, helping us, keeping it away from the structure. So I walk out onto the little rocky outcropping, and I'm watching the fire down the other side just to keep an eye on it, and the wind changes. And it happens all the time. Comes back up the drainage on the other side towards the house, so I get the crew ready to go. We got the truck and pump gear ready to spray water if we need to. As the fire comes, they have two more dozers coming up to give us a hand. They start trying to push the fire away, and it jumps over them and jumps over them and it jumps over them, which happens. Just the amazing fire activity that was going on. And finally, the dozers pull out. It was just a little unsafe, and it was just running away from them. And it was like, no problem. We've got lots of water up here. We've got sprinklers set up. Fire does its thing. It's burning away from the home. As it comes closer, we'll spray a little bit of water, push it away, get it away from the house, and after a couple hours, 2-3 hours, the fire activity's kind of died down, and we can do mop up, clean up around the area, and the structure's still standing. We did our job.
And I'm guessing at way before this point, residents are evacuated.
Oh, yes. Yeah. When they send out level 1, level 2, level 3 evacuations, level 3 is you need to get out now. Now,
some people are stubborn, though, aren't they?
Yeah, they don't leave, until the county sheriff of that county actually removes them from the structure.
That point, the county sheriff's life is probably already in danger if it's
yes,
at that point.
So yes.
For people that are thinking about doing that, don't, right?
Yeah.
We live by a simple philosophy, risk a lot to save a lot, risk little to save little. Same thing with this. Your house and everything, we understand. But when you're in a level 3, get out. And then that helps us do our jobs as well.
Yeah.
So one of the other things that I get asked a lot about, especially when we start running the PSAs and things like that, is obviously when there's a burn ban, we're talking about debris burn and yard burn and stuff mm-hmm. like that. What is the – is there another ban when it comes to campfires and that's different? In other words, can someone still have a campfire when there's a burn ban, depending on conditions, I would imagine? Can they have a warming fire at their house? What are some of the regulations for that? Because I have people asking me all the time, can I have a warming fire at my house?
We do. We follow the ODF standards when this comes in. It's green, yellow, red, orange colors, if I remember right.
Or yellow's
orange,
high.
Orange, red. Sorry. Yeah, and it's mild, moderate, extreme, and absolutely don't do anything. Yeah. Right now we're in high burn area. Mm-hmm. It's anticipated with the weather coming up, we're actually going to go extreme. So by that, each different color, it defines what you can and cannot do in the area. And then, of course, in the city, has different ordinances that we have to, you know, abide by. But outside of the city, we generally follow that color diagram and say, okay, we're in mild. We can do whatever what's going on within limits. And then if we're in extreme, the other side of the pendulum spectrum, then we absolutely don't ask that nobody does anything during that time. And that includes, like, not mowing your yard.
Right.
Or you have a spark resistor.
Chainsaws.
Right, exactly.
Yeah, because I noticed that I think last week or so the ODF came out and there were some areas in high, but some campgrounds were still allowing campfires. So it I guess has to get to that extreme level where – or it depends on the area.
It does. And then the geographical area that we are at, we always get that coastal inversion come in at night, which saves us. I mean, it brings in that humidity, drops the temperatures down every night because the valley gets warm and so it sucks in that inversion. That's the good thing for where we live, and that's where – the campgrounds can have campfires in those areas.
But we don't, with that inversion, we don't bounce back from medium to high to medium to high, no. medium to high every time, does it? We stick what's the most closest level to what's going to be during the daytime hours, I would imagine.
Yeah. And the real big concern in our area is the east winds. If we have east winds coming from the east to west, which normally our winds come from the northwest and blow through, if we get the east winds, everybody gets more alert because they're
dry.
Exactly. And the temperature usually goes in the 90s and 100s in here, believe it or not. And the relative humidity that we talked about drops into the teens and 20s. And then we have sparking lines going off everywhere. We have little fires that we can jump on and get taken care of quickly, but it could be big fires. Now, not to throw panic into this, but if we talk about the Sweet Creek fire, had that happened a week later with the east winds that happened at Holiday Campfire, that fire growth and behavior would have been catastrophic up the valley, Sisal Valley. Thankfully, the timing of it was the way it did.
Absolutely.
Yeah, and it usually seems like when we get those east winds, they're definitely not as heavy as the northwest winds coming through there. So it kind of like just creeps in on you.
Yep.
Sort of gets warmer and drier all of a sudden, and the next thing you know, boom.
Yeah, you can definitely feel it in the morning when you walk out. It's like, oh, it's an east wind day. Let's go golfing.
Yeah, that's what it is. Well, I want to thank you both for being here. I appreciate all the information there. Thank you for your service and your gang going out there and taking care of some of that stuff for the people in the east there.
Oh, yeah. No, it's a privilege. You know, we love to take care of our community, and when another community needs help, it's just an honor to be able to go out and help them out.
When I look at it the other way, too, is that if we're able to, you know, attend the call for help. Someday we may need that call for help to come in our area.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Probably going to be a tsunami or an earthquake.
Well, so hopefully it never happens in our
hopefully
lifetime.
Never in our, hopefully it doesn't happen in anybody's lifetime, right. But, you know, for that matter. Matt House, Deputy Fire Chief over at the Westland Fire and EMS Authority. Blair Campbell, thank you so much for both being here.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Coming up next on Our Town, Alicia Dean Nicola speaks with the new owner of the Ken Kesey House from Sometimes a Great Notion.